Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today I have my good friend Chad Carson from CoachCarson.com joining us. Chad is a real estate entrepreneur and genius and is a whole bunch of other things too. And Chad's actually literally sitting across the table from me right now, which is real exciting. Usually I don't get that lucky. So Chad, welcome to the show.
And it's great to be here, Travis. And you set me up well with the genius comment. I'm not sure I could follow up on that.
Well, I'd like to first start with you bragging a little bit about your athletic career, because that's something that a lot of people can relate to. Maybe not everybody can relate to being, you know, a bazillionaire and having, you know, all these rental properties, but I think certainly people can relate to college football. So tell us a little bit about your experience athletically.
I'm 39 years old now, but my life before adulthood was I was a football player, an athlete. I got a scholarship to play football at Clemson University. So go Tigers. At that point, we weren't national champions yet, but we were pretty good. And I played middle linebacker for the football team and started 3 years there. And it paid for my school. I mean, you talk a lot about student debt, and I feel like the fortunate one in that I had a job basically that paid for my school, and I was able to get out of college, that part of college, without debt. But it was a really good experience for a lot of reasons. I mean, getting into business and investing, just like mindset of athletics, I think was very helpful, and self-discipline. But it also taught me, like, one of the reasons I got into being an entrepreneur was I was sort of in this, it felt like a corporation being on a football team where you're going to meetings and you always have to be here. It's like the army or something. When I got done, I was like, you know what? I was a biology major thinking about applying to, I'd applied to 5 med schools. I said, I'm just going to take a break for a year or two because I need some freedom. I need some time for myself. And I ended up never going back. It's like that Matrix, you know, part of the Matrix movie, which I love, you know, the two pills and which pill are you going to take? And I took the freedom flexibility pill, and I never could go back in that back the other way that I thought I was going to go.
Can I ask you how many tackles you had in your career?
No, I don't remember, but I had a friend who looked it up on the Clemson website and said I still had like top 5 in the history of Clemson or something. Yeah.
Why did you go to the NFL?
Well, I tried. The NFL didn't want me, but I didn't try that hard. Like I went to some combines. I had a lot of injuries my senior year, and it's a long road. It's kind of like anytime you go to any professional athletics, you have to kind of stick with it and you have to go to the minor leagues. I could have gone to the Canadian Football League. And to be honest with you, I always dreamed of playing college football. And I really never had aspirations of going pro. And if the opportunity was there, I would have taken it. But when it wasn't that easy, I said, I'm moving on from this and going to something else.
It's okay. So you took the, the Colton Bachelor route, pretty athletic, but you go the fame and fortune route instead of the professional.
I guess so. Yeah.
So you're also very successful in real estate investing. So can you tell us approximately how many properties you own now and when you got started and what your philosophy is on real estate investing?
Yeah. So I started right after college when I decided not to go to the NFL and not to go into med school, and just started from scratch there. I can tell you a little bit more about that, but where we ended up now is we have a business partner. So he and I own everything 50-50, and we have it's about 110 units right now. So that we've grown to that, you know, acquired a lot of those in the last few years. But when we started off, I was just trying to make a living as an entrepreneur. So it's a lot like you think about inventory in a store. You got to buy low, sell high. You know, Walmart has to do that, or any store has to do that. That's basically what we did. We would go out and find real estate deals and try to find like the diamond in the rough, try to find something we could get below value and either fix it up and resell it. Or in some cases, we would just like sell it wholesale to somebody else, to another investor. So wholesale means instead of like, it's just a small markup. So like the company that sells the products at a store to the store just makes a tiny little markup. And then the store makes the big, huge markup. So we would just find the deals and make a few thousand bucks, for example, or 5,000 bucks and just quickly turn it. And that's how I made a living for at least 2 or 3 years. So we started doing a little bit more, got into rental properties. And I see them as two different businesses. Like the route I went as an entrepreneur in real estate is it's sort of the minority of people who get into that. That's more of a full-time thing. It's basically you making a living doing that. And whereas real estate investment is a much broader kind of audience of people who can get into it. You can get into it really small scale, doing a few properties. A lot of people I know do that. Or you can do what we've done. We've done it full-time and own more units and kind of get into the management of it and doing that as well.
Okay. And then the 110 units is like so above most people listening right now in terms of like visualizing that, right?
Yeah.
People could probably visualize one. So what's an example of your one of your first rentals that maybe was all you, if there was ever one that was just you, and kind of what did that look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. So my favorite way to get started is the way I got started with rental properties was I was in a college town. And I had it's a fixer-upper fourplex building, which means it's one roof with four front doors, four apartments inside the building. You can also find duplexes and triplexes or houses with basement apartments. They're all kind of similar. And so I found this property that needed work and was able to buy it at a good price from a bank, so bank foreclosure. And so I bought it, scrapped some money together to buy that and had to borrow most of the money to do it, but got it fixed up and got the other three units rented out. And then I moved into unit number two, which is the worst unit in the building. And then the other three paid for my mortgage on the property, my taxes, my insurance, even my maintenance. So I was basically living for free in what's called a house hack. It's a big term these days, house hacking. But by me getting started that way, it's really cool because you have to have a place to live. But I was able to move into a rental unit, live there for a few years. When I got married, my wife, we moved in there together as well. But then the cool thing is now we still own that building. And so we still rent it out and it's not our residence anymore. But it's a really nice transition from being a residence to reduce your housing payment to being something you can keep long run. And I've seen a lot of people do that.
You moved with your new wife into the worst unit?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She learned early. Like when I picked her up for the first date, I had this old 1995 Toyota Camry. It was all beat up and it had like, I buy houses written on the side of it. So I asked her later, I was like, what'd you think about my car? She's like, well, I didn't think you owned the car. I thought you just drove somebody else's company car and you just worked for somebody else. I said, no, I am the company. That's me. That's what we do.
That's pretty funny. I lost a date once over taking somebody to Wendy's on a date. So,
it's a good filter. I mean, the frugal thing or the entrepreneur thing, if she had gotten up and got out of the car, I would say, okay, well, that's cool. I have to go find somebody else.
Yeah, full disclosure, we're far from perfect here. Don't worry, I don't take my wife on dates to Wendy's now.
Yeah, me neither.
So that's one example. Was this the one with Merry Christmas spray painted on the front of it?
It was ugly, yeah.
Okay. Is this an auction or you said it was a bank foreclosure?
The bank had just taken it back at foreclosure. And I do a lot of networking in my town. And so I just had another investor who happened to talk to the banker and they had already taken it back at the foreclosure auction, which for those who don't know what that means, like when you get a mortgage on a property, so you have that debt, with a mortgage, if you don't make your payments, the bank has to go through, it depends on the state, but the bank goes through a process of taking that property back legally. And in South Carolina, there's a judicial court case that goes. And so that court case had just happened. The judge had just given the property to the bank because nobody else bid enough to get it. So we just happened to be the right place at the right time. That's a pretty common thing. People can look out for this term called REO. That's not REO Speedwagon. It's means real estate owned is the title for it. And so when banks take a property back, they end up putting it on the market, typically with a realtor selling it to somebody else. And that's essentially what I did. I just got in a little bit early.
This kind of thing sounds like it could work pretty well if you're in a small, medium-sized town where kind of everybody knows everybody and you're not going to have a bunch of hedge fund kind of people in New York that are bidding based off computer models, right? Like I'm imagining this doesn't work at all in New York City where there's 1,000 people showing up for an auction, but it might work great in these small towns.
Well, here's what the hedge fund thing is a phenomenon where, you and I are, I consider myself a small investor. Even people might hear 110 properties, that seems big, but we are mom and pop investors compared to people who own 80,000 properties like hedge funds. But I think we have competitive advantages as people who are just buying a couple of properties. And one of those is just human-to-human contact. And so a hedge fund, yes, can come up with millions or billions of dollars to buy a bunch of stuff, but they can't talk to a person one-on-one and connect with them any better than you or I can. In fact, we might be able to do that better. And so there's a lot of opportunities to, yes, network in a small or medium-sized town, but even in New York City, I think people are people are people everywhere. And there are some people who are going to say, I don't care how much money that person has. I'm not going to sell it to them because they're a jerk. Yeah. Whereas if you sit down and talk to somebody and you're sincere and you show them what you're trying to do, I've just found there's a lot of people who are willing to work with you. And so that's what the competitive advantage we have to have as small real estate investors is get to talk to people, just connect with people, whether that's the real estate agent, the owner of the property, an attorney who works for that person. That's how you find these opportunities.
So basically, you don't be a jerk.
Yeah. pretty much, and talk to people.
Yeah, don't be a jerk and talk to people. So in terms of tax efficiency, so we got a lot of people listening to this that are very concerned with their AGIs, their adjusted gross incomes, because they're trying to get loan payments that are as low as possible because they're going for forgiveness. And any investments that throw off a bunch of taxable income would actually be a bad thing for them.
Right.
And real estate gets plugged a lot, both correctly and incorrectly, by a lot of these folks that are looking for tax shelters. Mm-hmm. And people talk about real estate as the best tax shelter since Cayman Islands or something, right? So how true is that? Is real estate actually a good tax shelter? And what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know there's no magic silver bullet, right? I mean, there's always good and bad. Real estate in general is more tax efficient than, let's compare it to something else. Let's compare it to if you were just to make a loan to somebody, and you may or may not want to do that, but let's say they paid you 6% interest on a loan. When you make that interest, that 6% interest, that's completely exposed to tax. You're going to be taxed at the same rate you would as if you made your job, your salary, or wherever you're working. And that's not a good thing in terms of tax efficiency. So you would consider that a bad tax investment for investing, unless you invested somewhere else, like an IRA or a 401k or something. Well, real estate, let's say I make that same percentage in rent. Let's say I buy a property for $100,000 and I get back a $6,000, I just pay cash for it. Keep it really simple. I get back $6,000 a year in net rental income. Well, it's not exactly like that interest income because of some of the qualities of real estate that make it more tax efficient. So for example, one thing that you have is that you have something called depreciation. Sometimes it goes over people's head what that means. It's a tax term and you're like, I don't really want to pay attention to that. But essentially what depreciation does is it reduces the amount of that $6,000 that's exposed to taxes right now. It's called sheltering it. And I don't know, we can get into details of how that kind of works if you want to.
Let's slow down on that a little bit. So you said $6,000 of rental income is what we're assuming, and say the property is worth $100,000 maybe to keep the math easy.
Yeah.
So you've got the $6,000 income, and depreciation means that you can take that $100,000 and reduce the value of it over time, right?
Yeah. So the IRS actually requires you to do this. So when you buy a property, you spend $100,000 on it. But what the IRS says, and rightfully so, that building is going to be worn down over time. Everything deteriorates. You give it long enough, it's going to turn into dust. And so they have a chart that basically says if you have a residential property, that property will deteriorate over 27 and a half years.
Okay.
You can't expense that property in year one. But what they will do is they'll say it's actually not $100,000 because the land is part of that. So you have the land as part, and then the building actually goes down in value. So you can depreciate the building over 27 and a half years. And whatever that percentage comes out to, I don't know if you have a calculator, we can figure that out.
Yeah, pull it up. So it's about $3,600 if we take $100,000 divided by 27.5.
Yeah. So $3,600. So let's go back to our example. We had $6,000 in net rental income. We have $3,600 in depreciation expense. Now we call that an expense, but that money is not going out of our pocket every single year. That money, we already spent money on the property up front. That $3,600 is what's called a paper expense. Mm-hmm. The good for you as a real estate investor is that basically reduces that $6,000 by $3,600 in terms of what you pay taxes on.
Okay. So I'm paying taxes on $2,400.
Correct.
And the net rental income, is that after interest on your mortgage loan?
So that's assuming we didn't have any interest on our mortgage. So, that simple example, but if you had a mortgage, so if you borrowed some of that money, which a lot of people would early on, you would reduce the amount of net rental income you have. So maybe that goes from, maybe let's say you borrowed $50,000 and you had $200 a month in interest. Let's say you had $3,000 a year in interest. And so that would reduce that as well. And so you could actually have a loss on the property on paper and not have any taxable income. In general, if you make more money, if you work a full-time job as a professional, you're not going to be able to use that loss that you have on the rental property to offset much of your regular active income. Although eventually you will. When you sell the property, you can use it, you can carry it forward. But it's not like a real tax strategy to have a big loss on your real estate and be able to save a bunch of money on your medical salary. That's not it used to be a thing, but Congress caught up with that and changed the laws back in 1987.
But you said carry forward. So if I have another rental property that doesn't have a negative loss, I can offset that income with that loss, right? And if I have a bunch of ones that have losses now, eventually my rental income, I don't have depreciation anymore. right?
Yes.
So I don't have any more depreciation. So now I don't get that write-off. So now I have to pay more taxes. Correct. I could write off some of that loss from early on my income later. So am I hearing that right?
Yeah, correct. So it's a passive loss. So if you have passive income, you can use that passive loss to offset any rental income from another property. Or if you happen to have passive income somewhere else, you can use it offset. So there are definitely some benefits of that. I think most people perceive it as this is where the magic silver bullet comes in. Like, I'll make $500,000 a year. I need to buy a bunch of real estate to reduce my taxable income, from my medical income. It's like, it doesn't typically work that way. But what it does is that any investment returns you make are going to be much more efficient, and you can pay a lot less taxes on those. And that's a good thing. Like, that's one of the biggest drags on your investment return is going to be taxes. And so and real estate is just like built for that. It's really built for being I would compare it to an IRA or a 401k in that way. And I think it's more flexible than those kind of accounts in many ways. Like, I invest in my IRA, my 401k as well. But real estate, I really like it because it didn't have a lot of the limitations of 59 and a half to be able to start withdrawing your money. And so if you're an early retiree, financial independence kind of person where you're trying to be flexible and not have to wait until you're 60 years old to retire, real estate has a lot of benefits in that kind of plan.
That's great. So I've got this 20 something years that I've gotten depreciation for. So now I basically, my house is worth zero, right? Or my property's worth it's worth zero. And if I sold it, the entire thing would be a gain, right?
Yeah. And I just want to make a comment about that. From a tax standpoint, yes, you've depreciated your property and you have no, from the IRS's standpoint, you have no basis. But remember, like in real estate, just reminding everybody, like in most cases, that real estate's increased in value a lot. Like, it's the land underneath it has gone up in value, and you've probably maintained the property, or at least I hope you will. And so the property tends to get worth a lot more than that over 20 years. But from a tax standpoint, you've depreciated your basis in the property, which means those tax benefits kind of go away after 27 and a half years.
So say I have this big gain. Right. So let's say that I bought it for $100,000, I depreciated it a bunch, and now it's worth $200,000. So I would have a $200,000 gain if I sold it after all that depreciation, right?
Yeah.
So there's something that we were talking about at lunch today called a 1031 exchange. Mm-hmm. And I've got the no more depreciation left to go. I've got $200,000 that I might have to pay gains on. What can I do with real estate instead of paying gains on that? And, is there a way to avoid that?
Yeah. So at the risk of losing people with like IRS terms again, like the 1031 exchange in essence is a way to trade from one property to another property and not pay taxes in the interim. Like, and we all know that's a good thing because remember tax can be a really big drag. If you have a big gain and you pay a lot of taxes on that gain, you're basically giving that money to the IRS today and you can't use it to go buy something else. So this tool called a 1031 exchange is as part of the IRS code that allows you to do this. If you follow the rules, you can go from one property to another property. You can sell property one, you can buy property two, and you can use 100% of that money to buy property two. That's the beauty of it. You can do that over and over and over again and never, theoretically never pay tax on a property as long as you kept trading and trading and trading. And there are some rules there. You have to buy a property. You have to buy a like kind. So like you couldn't go buy, like I couldn't sell my rental property and go buy like shares in a startup corporation or something. There's some rules about what kind of exchanging you can do. But if you look those rules up, you follow them. And I personally hire a 1031 intermediary. Like, you want a third party to like help you.
Lawyers, basically.
Yeah, they'll have companies, sometimes they're lawyers or CPAs, but they're licensed on the line to make sure you do this correct. And so it's worth the money to help you do it. But when you do that, you're saving like, if you had taxes on a $100,000 gain, that's a really big deal. You're essentially investing with the house's money. You're taking the money you would have paid in taxes and using that to buy the next property, and that'll compound and compound and compound over time.
Can that be a property I already own, or does it have to be a different property?
Maybe a new property.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the biggest challenges of 1031 exchanges, they're really good in theory. The challenge is executing it. One of the key rules is that when you sell that property one, you have to replace it with a property within 180 days of that. and you have to identify a property that you're going to, you might buy, or multiple. You could identify like 10 properties that you're looking at, or it might be less than that, it might be four or five properties, and within 45 days. So within 45 days of selling it, you've got to say, this is the property I want to buy. And so that's, that window is kind of the challenge. And so you have to be looking ahead of time. You've really got to know where you're going to be hoping to buy and have some prospects on the line. And because if you don't, then you lose the opportunity and you have to pay the tax.
So what's the benefit of this? It sounds good not to pay taxes, but at the end of the day, I want income from my rental properties, right? Or I want, I guess from rentals, you probably want income from speculative stuff.
Maybe yeah. I mean, the benefit is over time, real estate, your return on your equity in that real estate goes down because the value is going up. So typically in a lot of the, just think about California and some areas like that where, you know, prices have just gone crazy, running away. You might've had a property that used to be worth 400,000 is now worth $1 million.
Yeah.
And the rents have not kept up with that. And so you've got all this equity, this kind of dead equity, it's not being used. And so you could trade that $1 million and go buy a property that has a 10% return. And so you might now be able to get $100,000 on your $1 million in equity, whereas before you might have been getting, you know, $20,000.
Wow. So in other words, if you own a California property, like what if this is your primary residence? What if you have a home in San Francisco that you bought for $300,000, it's worth $1 million? Can you do this with your own house?
It's even better with your own house. There's actually another IRS rule that allows you to sell your house, and up to, I think it's $500,000 for a couple, you have an exemption where you wouldn't pay any tax anyway, as long as you've lived in that house for a couple of years, I think 2 out of the last 5 years. So that rule is even better than 1031, because you could sell the property, have that $500,000 in gain as a couple, or $250,000 as an individual, and then you could just put the cash in the bank and not have to buy another property. But if you are in that situation where you have a rental property in California and you just want to take that money and kind of invest in something else, a very common strategy is people on the East and West Coast sell that property that's appreciated, buy something in the interior of the country that has a little bit better cash flow, maybe as a long distance investor, and then live off of that for income now that they've kind of cashed in their chips a little bit.
So really, like, I could sell my $1 million property in California and I could buy 10 properties in Vegas, 10 properties in St. Louis, 10 in Detroit.
Right.
And instead of the risk of one area, I've got multiple areas now, and I've got multiple tenants instead of maybe just one.
Correct.
So that's really cool, because, you know, I mean, I feel like this is super unfair because I'm a stock and mutual fund investor pretty much only. And so I've got all these, you know, investments that I'm like, golly, I wish I had figured out a way to get tax losses out of stuff so I could get out of this stuff. And, you know, like even stuff like when I got married, I didn't think I'd be in that high of a tax bracket one day. And now I am.
Good problems to have, right?
You realize you have some investments that you're like, oh, I don't care that I'm paying like ordinary tax rates on this stuff, like in my taxable account. I just like that it has a 5% super inefficient dividend, you know? And then all of a sudden you're losing like half of it. And you're like, oh, shoot. Like, I try to sell it.
Sell it. Now you have a gain that you have, yeah, you'd make, pay even more tax on that.
Yeah. Right? I mean, like, I joke with some of our clients, some of these issues with making so much money and having so much debt is kind of a first world problem. I'm joking about, like, oh, my poor little self, like my 5% dividend, right? Like, check your privilege, Travis, you know? But yeah, I'm envious that you have all these cool loopholes. I'm even more envious that you know about them. So you coach people on their real estate investing. And you do this kind of partly for, mostly for fun, really, because you, I mean, you make plenty of money on your, you know, your real estate stuff, but you have a blog, coachcarson.com, where you have a lot of great courses and a book that I'm going to have you autograph for me later. What's the book called?
The book is called Retire Early with Real Estate. And I'm going to autograph it. That sounds good.
Yeah. So you can get that on Amazon. So let's say that you've got a dentist, and I think you, one of your parents was a dentist, right?
Yeah, my mom was a dentist for 30 plus years. Yeah.
Okay. So you've got a dentist and she really wants to get started with real estate investing because she likes that she can see it. And she's got a little bit of money going away in a tax bomb account for the student loan forgiveness thing. Mm-hmm. And she's making her payments on her loans and she has got 400,000 of debt, but she's got 200,000 of income and she can get approved basically because she can use her payment on her loans under these income driven plans, and they let you make that your payment instead of a $4,000 a month kind of penalty that they're kind of penalizing you with when you're figuring out your, what you qualify for, for your mortgage.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So she qualifies for a mortgage. She's found a place and she has some options in terms of properties. So she lives in one right now that's a $2,000 a month mortgage. What would you suggest for her? What should her long-term game plan be? Like, should she try to start with one? Should she try to go for a multi-unit, like a fourplex is what they call it, I think? You know, what would be the way you would coach somebody, whether or not they should be aiming for, you know, a couple properties or 10 or, you know, 100 like you?
Yeah. You know, when somebody first talks to me, sometimes I try to talk people out of it. And I know that sounds a little ironic, but my first question for somebody who's a busy professional, which I know a lot of your audience will be, is real estate the right thing for you, you know, time-wise and hassle-wise? Because your number one wealth-building tool is your income and your ability to save your income. So let's just put that on the table, right? Real estate is just going to be a potential vehicle to invest some of that money. And I think it's a great one. But I think the general strategy, no matter what specific technique you would probably use, I think you got to understand that your life like is busy and you got all that stuff going on. So keep your real estate strategy as simple as possible. And it would be really nice if you could sort of kill two birds with one stone. I don't know if that's a good analogy anymore, but you know, you can do two things at once. Like if you could turn your residence into an investment, if you're willing to do that, I'm not sure, you know, this is kind of like the millionaire next door where they talked about the doctor who like lived in the neighborhood that nobody really knew he was that wealthy. And like, if you're willing to do that for 5 to 10 years of your life, you can live like super high on the hog later on. Like, so I think that's just a good strategy, and house hacking is one way to sort of manifest that in the real estate world. So instead of you living in the 4,000 square foot, like awesome dream house, just put that off. Right? Put it off for 5 years, 10 years, and live in one or two house hacks. And this could be a fourplex like I lived in, if you have them in your town, but very often that kind of inventory is not around. So what you might do is live in a duplex, live in one side of a duplex, or find a, you know, just a more bread and butter style house that has a basement apartment, that has a garage apartment, you know, something where you can generate some income from your property. I like that strategy. Or even if you can't do that, like just live in a modest house that once you move out of the house, you can keep it as a rental property once you move out.
So let me see if I understand this. So I have the opportunity right now, we live in this building that's like four different units in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that we could live in one of them and buy the fourplex. And I think there's some sort of rule, right, where the max loan a bank will give you is for a fourplex.
Correct. Yeah. So the loan universe out there for mortgage loans, the easiest loans to get, the best loans to get are in the residential mortgage world, which they consider 1 to 4 units.
Okay.
So as long as you stay within that 1 to 4 units, you can get pretty much the same kind of mortgage you could get on any house.
Mm-hmm. So fourplex is the max that I can get a really great, easy to qualify for a residential loan. Is that like with even like Freddie Mac kind of underwriting or something?
Yeah, you can go the different terms. Like they have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or your conventional, what are called conventional loans, where you put 20% down, get the best interest rate possible. That just gives you the most options out there. But there's also some other programs with like low down payments. Like there's FHA loans and there's some other down payment programs. Like even if you didn't have, if you're buying a $400,000 property and you didn't have 20% down, they might have some 5% down and some 3.5% down programs. And so especially in that first deal, like I don't mind, I know that's a lot of leverage, but here you are getting out of debt on your other areas, but you've got to live somewhere. And if you treat your residence like a business, I just think it's a smarter long-term move, and owning your real estate and then buying it as if it's an investment gives you flexibility, because if you move 3 years from now, you can keep that and rent it out and have it pay for itself and hire a property manager and not have to, you know, do everything yourself.
Yeah, I mean, so it's basically just diversification. So house hacking is basically, I live in one of the four fourplexes.
Correct.
And I've got three other units. And so maybe I buy the fourplex for say 600 grand. And so my mortgage is maybe what, like $3,000-$4,000 a month.
Right.
So I've got the three other places paying me $1,000 a month, and that almost maybe covers my mortgage. And so I'm building up an asset that's worth $600,000 plus inflation over time. Mm-hmm. As long as your neighborhood doesn't go to junk, yep. Which is possible.
It's, I mean, always possible.
That's,
yeah.
That's risk, but you know, it's a low risk, I think, mm-hmm. for most people. So if it works out, you basically could move out of that, I guess, is what you're saying too. Like if, say you live in that, yep. you know, that unit, well, I guess you wouldn't sell it. You probably just keep renting it if you have the other three you rented, right?
Probably just keep renting it, but you could sell it. You could sell it and do 1031 exchange. You could, I mean,
into a new house like that you would live in?
Yeah, you could sell that and use your equity to go buy a house that you live in if you wanted to. I mean,
without paying taxes?
No, so it gets a little complicated. You could save on taxes, yes, because you lived in one out of the four, like 25% of that property you'd be able to save on taxes because that was your residence.
Oh.
And all this is stuff like I'm kind of giving you what I think just because I read this stuff and I'm a nerd, but like you work with your CPA on all this. I use a CPA. Like I hire a CPA, even though I nerd out on this stuff and read it, it's very important because real estate tax, as much as it is beneficial to you, is one of the most complicated things. Like I've read articles that go like 5,000 words on depreciation and how you recapture it when you sell a property. It gets like super crazy complicated. Jeez. And it's not for the layman. It's like not that fun to read. So you really need to have your CPA look it over with you.
But it doesn't have to be bad, right? Like if I have a CPA and I probably can pay him or her a fair price, you know?
Especially it's a transactional thing. So you have a CPA help you prepare your tax return. Like I do that. And that might be pretty straightforward most years. And then when you sell a property though, before you go sell it, you'll have a consultation with your CPA and say, all right, what are my implications of me selling this? Like, and they'll show you what it's going to be. And you sort of just use them as a tax advisor.
How much does that cost?
You know, a couple $100 an hour.
Yeah.
Something like that. So yeah, $200 to $400 for a consult is a good deal when you're talking like $20,000 to $30,000 in tax potentially.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I need to be scared because that's less than what we charge, at least for some of it. Although I would say that we save people a projected average of $50,000 instead of just $20,000. So that's me justifying the extra fee.
The more value, the more it's worth.
Yeah, but we charge less than the other ones on the lower debt cases. So we talked about house hacking a little bit. So that's really interesting. I think that would be a really cool way for somebody to get started living this creative alternative lifestyle that most people don't do. Mm-hmm. And you could probably find a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex starting out if you really want to live in a place that you own that you can hammer whatever you want to into the walls. Mm-hmm. So that seems pretty neat. So that's how house hacking, right? Like there's generally, is it always like a duplex or fourplex? Like house hacking for an individual residence, like a single family home, that's probably not as much of a thing.
Yeah, there's a little variation on it. I mentioned it for a little bit is you can move into a regular house and not rent it to anybody while you live there. But then 2 years later, when you move out, you can then keep it as a rental property. If you want to get nerdy with it, like on my website, I go into each of these strategies and that I call that a live in then rent. And it's just a cousin of the house hack. It's, you know, it's for people who like, I'm not going to live next door to my tenant. Sorry, just not going to work for me. But or I just can't find a duplex or a triplex. You kind of get the same principle. You're not saving any money while you live there. But 2 years later, you move out and now you have a rental property. And one of the biggest deals of house hacking and this whole strategy is you're using a residential owner-occupied loan, which has all of those benefits that we talked about. Lower down payment, better interest rate, easier to get. If you're a medical professional or you know professional with good income, you probably can get these mortgages. And so you're really benefiting from what you have, which is good income, good credit, and you're taking advantage of it early in your career. And then, you know, 5 to 10 years later, you move on and now you have 2 or 3 rental properties that you can keep. And what's really cool, like I found, is once you start making more income, once you get your debt paid off on your student loans, this is like a ready-made place that you can start putting your extra cash. Like you have a 5% loan, 6% loan. That's a low-risk way to sort of reduce your risk, increase your income later on down the road. Like leverage is great early on, but as you're kind of moving towards a lower risk, long-term kind of profile as an investor, you can pay off some of that debt as well and have a good place to put your money.
So a lot of people that are putting money into real estate, crowdfunding right now is really popular. There's a bazillion different companies. We were talking about this a little earlier about whether that's legit or not. What is your view of crowdfunding in general?
Yeah. So let me explain what crowdfunding is because it's a lot of different things. It's basically the movement of, it used to be like in the real estate world, it's all like in back room, you know, mostly men who had a lot of money. Those are the only people who ever had access to like the really good deals where people would kind of pool their money together and buy these big buildings. So it's kind of like a backroom thing. Like the positive part about crowdfunding is it's a more public, you know, internet-based way for you and I and like the general public to have access to these big, to a lot of real estate deals. So that's cool. You know, I like that concept. Crowdfunding's cool. The challenge of it, I think, like the verdict's still out for me. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm playing around with it myself. You know, I'm doing some things like where I'm making loans to people. You know, like, and instead of me making $100,000 loan, I'm making $25,000 loans or, you know, or even more. That I'm splitting that money up and making like a piece of a bunch of different loans. So I like that diversification of not just one loan with one property. So those are some like positive sides of crowdfunding. the challenge I've found is that I think real estate, everything we've talked about today, is really good for people who like get involved kind of like an entrepreneur, and you look at the property and you understand the market and you get involved in picking a manager or picking the tenant. That's part of the benefit of real estate. It's also one of the challenges of it. It's a little bit more entrepreneurial and takes a little bit more time up front. But I think you can use your intuition and your knowledge of the local market to make a good deal. Well, when you go into crowdfunding, like what competitive advantage do you and I really have buying all these deals? And do we really, like, there's an information issue. Like I don't know that even me, when I'm looking at it, can I really look at all the information they're giving me in that 150 page packet that their attorney drew up and understand all the risk, everything that's going on, you know, in these startup companies. And so I'm just a little nervous, cautious about kind of jumping in head first. And And that's for me, as somebody who's been doing this full time in real estate for 16 years, I get even more nervous when I see people who are like busy professionals who say, oh, this is a way for me to get in. And they just put a ton of money in there. Like, I think dipping your toe in is cool. Like, try it out. But I'm just not sure. I think you need to be ready to do as much due diligence with crowdfunding as you would on your own deals. And I don't think anybody's doing that. Like everybody's just pressing buttons and investing and thinking, oh, this is a passive way to do it. And I think that's the caution. Like, you got to treat it like a business, even though it seems really passive.
One thing that was really fun for me to learn about when I was a bond trader is liquidity matters. And what liquidity is how easy it is to get your money out of something. Mm-hmm. So a bank is super liquid. I can get my money out tomorrow. Mutual funds are also super liquid because I can't guarantee the price of what it's going to be, but I'm 100% positive that I can get my money out by selling it. Right. And whatever the stated public value is, I can get it in day's notice, basically, mm-hmm. if I sell it. So the thing that's concerning for me with crowdfunding, I actually had one of the crowdfunding companies that was kind of early on in my blogging career, I was an affiliate of theirs, and I saw something on their site that said, we beat the S&P, you know, by like, you know, 10% last year. Did you?
Oh, man.
And I was so turned off by that. I just sent them an email that said, I don't want to be an affiliate anymore. And they're like, why? And I pointed out that marketing. They're like, oh, well, we don't think it's that bad. And I thought, I felt like sent them a response like, I pulled money out of the S&P in a bear market, you know, to pay for something last year. Did you? You know, like if any of these crowdfunding things hit a 2008 type crisis, because all this stuff got passed in 2012, this stuff could all blow up and people couldn't get their money out. They'd have to take huge discounts to the value. So we'll see. I think crowdfunding might be okay to put maybe 10% of your portfolio in, but I think it's a lot more fun. Like, I think the people listening to this, you're either really interested in this stuff and you're either like, you know, listening to Chad with like, you know, your ears really perked up and you're like, wow, 1031, I can't wait to go learn about that, you know? Or you're like, whoa, not for me. I want to know about it so I can know about stuff like to not do. Yeah. But that's kind of the way I look at it is, you know, either get involved in it and make it a significant kind of third leg of your financial independence like journey, or just rely on other things, which is totally fine. So in terms of like how active this has to be, that's maybe a big misconception. So property managers, you hire one, you pay them 10% of the rent. They take the calls in the middle of the night from your tenants. What's the true cost of that? And how passive can you be with your own properties?
So real estate, I always tell people, is it starts off like a startup. Like, you know, you're starting up a business and it takes a bunch of time. Like, you've got to learn, you've got to build your team. And so even if you're a full-time professional, you probably need to set aside at least 10 to 20 hours a week to work on this, like early on, because there's a learning curve and there's some momentum that has to be picked up. But over time, long run, it doesn't have to always be that way. So like for me, I was full-time buying properties, looking at stuff. But then a few years ago, my wife and I and two kids went to Ecuador, and I basically spent like sometimes a half hour, sometimes 2 hours a week paying some bills and doing some bookkeeping. And sometimes I didn't have to do that. Like, so it can become very passive when you have property managers doing your day-to-day rental management. That is, there's systems for that. You can certainly hire people. You can certainly create spreadsheets and task lists that other people do. And you can just kind of manage the manager and watch what's happening. So that's a very realistic thing. But I think that early kind of getting over the hump of that early stage is what most people will get stuck on. As long as you know that, like, all right, for the next year or two, I'm getting this thing going. I got to have some time to be able to put into this. And once I get over that hump, great, I'm good. And I think if you go into that open-eyed, you know what you're getting into.
That's really interesting. So one idea that I've never heard before, you talked about commercial house hacking. well, like you put like a billboard in the side of your house or something for, you know, enjoy Coca-Cola and they pay you, I don't know. So commercial house hacking, you know, this is really interesting. And this applies to a lot of the people in this podcast that listen that might want to own their own practice, dental practice, veterinary practice, medical practice or something, or law practice one day. And a lot of times some of the deals involve owning the real estate for that building or complex, or whatever. So what is commercial house hacking?
I think maybe somebody's made that up before, but you and I were just like brainstorming and kind of made that up as we went. But the one reason I know about it is my mother was a dentist and my father was an entrepreneur. And so they actually owned the building where my mom had her practice. She had a partner in her dental practice. And so that dental practice was one entity. It rented the building. It rented that space in the building from my mom and dad, who owned the whole building. But that wasn't the whole space. Like, they had other space in the building that they rented out as well. And so essentially what my mom did as a dentist was took a kind of fixed cost that you always have, which is your rent on your building, and made money from that by also becoming the owner of the building. So that's essentially what I would call commercial house hacking. It's similar to what we talked about earlier with the residential house hack. You know, why go into a house and just throw your money away and make this huge mortgage payment when you could produce income from that property by renting out the extra space? That's essentially what this is. So if you're an attorney, you know, why not rent out, you know, extra office space to other attorneys? Like, create, you know, instead of having, you know, if you're going to buy a building, you know, have the space for your attorney office and then rent out the rest of the space to other attorneys, or buy a strip center where you have like 5 retail places. You rent out one, rent out the other 4 to somebody else. And here's the benefit of this. When you go to a bank to do a commercial loan to buy this property, just like in the residential world, there's the kind of risk levels. And the lowest risk loan, when you talk to a banker in the commercial world, is an owner-occupant business. So a business is going to move into that property because they have a lot to lose. You know, they're putting their billboard up there. They're, you know, putting their sign in front of there. They're staking their reputation on that. The chances of them leaving when things go bad are much lower than just me coming in and just buying a building just because it's a pure investment. And so for that reason, you'll probably have better loan terms, probably be easier to get a loan. And what you're essentially doing is making money in 2 different ways from your same practice that you already have.
That's really interesting. So in other words, you can pay down, have other people, other businesses pay down your loan that you have on this building that might be pretty valuable. And then you could also control who's next to you for your real estate. And so instead of having some really bizarre, you know, set up or like another dentist, right? Like, yeah, that shows up right next to you. You could kind of control who, right, you rent to. Yeah,
exactly. So it's kind of going vertical with your business. Like, it's so you have a dental practice, you have an attorney practice, you're going to keep growing that, but you're getting into real estate investing with what you know. I think if I had to summarize a lot of what this whole conversation is about for me, it's like going back to the Warren Buffett philosophy of you invest in things that you know and you understand. And so what do you know and understand? You know and understand what the location of a good dental practice is. You know, you know that because you are a dentist or you are an attorney, you are a veterinarian. And so I think that's the smart play. Like, anytime somebody gets you into an exotic, weird investment that you don't understand, just don't do it. Like, there's no reason to. There's always ways to make money close to home. If you don't have any way to make money close to home, just go put it in the whole market and buy an index fund. And that's really my whole approach. It's either get like really, really micro, really, really locally, invest in what you know, or own the entire market. Like, one of those two is probably like the best route to go.
Just to show the point of all this is making work optional and living life in your own terms, lowering your stress, doing the things that excite you and what you want to do. So with all this rental income, all this rental activity, you did something that's super weird and you know, compared to most people's definitions of what a normal life is. So you lived how long, where?
So my wife and I always had a dream of going and living abroad. So even we have 2 kids, so 6 and 8-year-old daughters now. But in 2017, in January of 2017, we moved and we rented our home back in Clemson, South Carolina for a couple of years. And we moved to Ecuador, to a place called Cuenca, Ecuador. And the reason was that it wasn't like, you know, big, huge reasons, but we wanted our daughters to become fluent in Spanish. My wife teaches Spanish. Foreign languages are sort of a hobby for me, just kind of fun to learn. It's a challenge. And so just that uprooting ourselves, living in another culture, getting to meet new people there. Our kids went to elementary school and preschool every single day. So they're, you know, just kind of threw them in the deep end of the pool. They had to learn Spanish or sink, you know, and they did great. They learned it. They even by about, it wasn't overnight, but by 6 months in, they would come home and we'd be speaking Spanish at the dinner table. And I had a head start on them, of course, but they would listen to my Spanish and they would kind of wrinkle their nose and like, then they point their finger at me and wag their finger and say, "Papa, no se dice eso." And they would correct my Spanish, you know, 6 months speaking. And I loved it. It was like, this is really awesome. My little kids are coming home and correcting my Spanish.
That's pretty epic. And that's when I think the first times that I realized how legit you were is when you did that. Because I think a lot of people can be like, oh, real estate, passive income, so easy. And then you get home, there's like 35 calls from tenants and like, you know, all these like bills and utilities are busted at one of them. The basin's flooded. But you're literally living half a world away from where all your investments are. And you had processes and stuff in place where it was literally automated for the most part, where it took up very little of your time and enabled you to do something that most people couldn't do, you know?
It was fun. It definitely takes a lot of work. And it kind of goes back to my conversation about real estate. There's nothing easy under the sun that's worthwhile. But if you can pay your dues up front with something like real estate, you can get good properties and you can just hang on. Like most of the good stuff in real estate happens like 10 years later. Yeah. You know, and so that's kind of like all of finances. If you're willing to defer a little bit of work and effort and savings, 10 to 15 years from now, you could have things like an early retirement or a mini retirement. We've taken some of those where you just take off for 6 months and have your investments support that flexibility. That to me, that's really what it's all about. That's why I wrote that book, Retire Early with Real Estate, because the idea is that, you know, money is cool. Like it's a fun thing to, you and I are nerds. Like we like spreadsheets. We just do this stuff for fun. But you know, most of us, we have these other things we want to do in our lives. Maybe it's spending time with our kids. Maybe it's traveling. Maybe it's a nonprofit that really matters to you, but it makes zero money, but that doesn't matter. It's important. You know, I'm really passionate about that. Like that's, how can we make money so that we can free up all of our time to do that kind of stuff, whatever that is. And because we need, that's what we need. Like we have so many people just grinding away at jobs all the time, making more money, more money, more money. And that's cool. You know, we all like our work, right? But do we like it enough to be spending, you know, that many hours doing that many things for our entire lives? Maybe. Like I think I'd call people's bluff on that. I think there's some other things that we have to do. And maybe it's both. You know, maybe it's we work for some, we take some break, we work some more. And so I think that's what this is all about. That's when you get down to all the X's and O's, the spreadsheets, the paying off debt, the investing your money, is having this thing, this idea, this destination that we're trying to go to that makes it all worthwhile.
Of course, the All-American linebacker brought in X's and O's. had to drop that in there. So football play analogy, right?
If they could see me talking, I was like acting like I was drawing on a whiteboard too. Like I was about to knock this microphone over five or six times.
That's a great branding exercise because you can find Chad at coachcarson.com because he loves teaching people about real estate and not in the, we're only going to have you in St. Louis for 24 hours. You got to show up and pay $1,000 for this useless seminar and kind of thing either. It's like legit, very methodical, very dispassionate, not super like promise the moon, kind of like a lot of this stuff is. So where can people find out more if they want to learn more about you and your business?
Well, my online home is coachcarson.com. And I would encourage people, you know, if you're interested in real estate, just learning more about it, I have a free toolkit at my site and it has a lot of practical stuff. Like I have a closing checklist. Like if you were going to go buy a property, this is the checklist I've used for the last 16 years. Like, you know, make sure you don't forget this, do this before closing, make sure you talk to your title insurance agent about this. So it's just, there's some tools like that, a closing checklist, all my formulas that I use when I'm analyzing deals, and just some free education and things that you get as part of that toolkit. And then every week I stay in touch with people on my Tuesday newsletter. So it's my way of just updating people what I'm up to. Here's the deal I'm working on. Here's behind the scenes. And if you go to coachcarson.com/newsletter, that's where you can get that toolkit and stay in touch with me that way.
That's great. And of course, because people that are hearing this are listening to a podcast, you also have a podcast, right?
I do. I got to start talking about my podcast more. So the Coach Carson podcast is something I'm doing every week. And I started in 2019. And it's a conversation about some of these same topics. I talk about financial independence and how to use real estate to do that. I'm going to start doing some interviews. I'm going to hopefully get Travis on the show before long, if I can talk him into that. But a lot of the times it's just me, you know, acting like I'm drawing on a whiteboard, teaching you what I know and sharing what I can, and just helping you, whether it's you buying one property or you buying 50 properties, I just want to help you make some progress and help you make it simple. Because real estate can seem complicated sometimes. There's people are incentivized to make it complicated, but in reality, there's some simple things that I try to just break down and give to you that you can go apply and make some money.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Travis.
Thanks for listening to today's show. You can email us your comments at podcast@studentloanplanner.com. You can also find show notes at studentloanplanner.com/the number of today's episode. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, schedule one today with one of our team members at studentloanplanner.com/book. Or if you want to learn more, visit /help. If you like the podcast, please share it with someone who owes more student loan debt than you do. Keep calm and build wealth, and have a great week.